Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program titled All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn. Our speaker is Jason Sokol, Associate Professor of History from the University of New Hampshire. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, African American Studies Program Director John Thornton.
Jason Sokol has come to us from New Hampshire, faraway New Hampshire. He teaches at the University of New Hampshire, and he's also, he's kind of a local guy. He grew up in Springfield, so it's not like he's far from here. And he went to Oberlin, which is pretty far away, I guess, and he got his PhD just to get farther away from Berkeley. So he's author of two books. The first book, which was There Goes My Everything, White Southerners in the Age of Civil Rights, was published by Knopf. Yes, a trade publication. And Jonathan Yardley, Washington Post? Is that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jonathan Yardley, the Washington Post, made it one of the 10 best books of 2006. And I was a former resident of the D.C. area for many years. I know Jonathan Yardley's work. Can't say I know him. But that's a big deal. That's a big deal. That's a big deal. And he's more recently published All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn, which, another trade publication, Basic Books, in 2014. So we're always lucky to have an academic with all of those credentials who also presents his work to the broader public in accessible, easy-to-read, non-technological or technical language. And so I'm really pleased and happy to be able to introduce him to you tonight. And so here's Jason Sokol.
Thanks, John, for that generous introduction. Happy to be here. Lucky to be here. You say you're lucky to have me here. I'm lucky to be here, to be speaking with, to all of you. About 4 or 5 years ago, I spoke across the street. I think it was at the Student Center. I spoke about Ed Brooke. And a gentleman who said he was one of Ed Brooke's cousins was at the talk. So if anyone is a relative of Ed Brooke, tell me now so I can, be on my toes. I understand that what I cover is something that a lot of people, I'm sure, in the audience have some experience with, so I'd be interested to hear what you think of my take on the issues and the history that I'm going to discuss. And the history is, this is a book about racial struggles in Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New York, basically from World War II to the present. And as John said, my first book was about the South, white Southerners during the Civil Rights Movement. And when I started my second book on race in the North, certainly the first thing I did was try to read everything that had been already written. And I found that I thought there was a real disconnect in terms of how Americans understood Northern race relations, a real disconnect between the popular imagination and on the one hand, and the scholarly literature on the other. And what I mean by that is that I think in the popular mind, there's still this idea that the North was and is a land of liberty, at least relative to the South. It's not as though 100% of Northerners or Americans believe that, but I think it still has resonance in the popular mind and in the American imagination this year, this idea of the North as the place of freedom. I do have some images as I go along, but I'm mindful that I'm being taped, so I'm not going to really be talking that much about them. It's just visual for you to take a look at. So, the idea of the home of the abolitionists and the Union Army fought on the right side of the Civil War. And certainly no scholar believes this. There have been slavery in the North is a burgeoning field. Many books about how New York City was literally built by slaves, and indeed many parts of New England as well. A book about Ten Hills Farm in Medford. So we know that there was slavery thriving in the North. Also, histories of civil rights in the North, I think, emphasize the bloody record of racial violence in Northern cities. And of course, this image made Boston synonymous with Northern racism. the image of the soiling of Old Glory in 1976 during the Boston busing crisis. But I think in recent works of history, in a way, scholars have gone to the other extreme, that is, to paint northern cities as places of vicious racism and unremitting segregation without relief, and almost to present the country as very similar in its segregation north and south. That is, the South had Mississippi, the North had the Boston busing crisis, therefore there's segregation and racism everywhere. And I take the point, but I don't think that that, I think that brushes over some really crucial distinctions about North and South. And that perspective didn't strike me as entirely correct, because I thought that at times the North and the places I studied, the Northeast, at times had been a model for the rest of the country. So I emerged with a portrait of the North and the Northeast in which I tried to tell basically two warring stories together, the story of freedom together with the story of segregation and racism. And so I argue that the cities and states of the Northeast were simultaneously beacons of freedom and bastions of racial segregation. And so, you know, my history is a history of these two traditions battling inside the northern soul. That explains the third title of my book. My book, I admit sheepishly that my book has three titles: All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn, The Conflicted Soul of the Northeast. And that's the fault of my editor, who wanted to put The Conflicted Soul of the Northeast in there, and that's the kind of tidbit you get to learn from actually coming to the talk about the book. Anyway, I blame her for that. I don't downplay the viciousness of racism and the importance of racial segregation and racial oppression in the North. Indeed, I document this ugly history. But I also take seriously some of the advantages and some of the freedoms that African Americans had in northern cities and states. Most importantly, the right to vote, which they exercised and which was meaningful, I think, throughout the World War II period and the years thereafter. So I came to believe that this kind of understanding of race in America, this kind of understanding of the North, can actually tell us a lot about how to understand race in America. That is, we are a nation with a black president on the one hand, and yet a nation, you know, where we have entrenched racism, entrenched discrimination, and the continuing horror of police brutality and assaults on African Americans in the streets. So I think we have those two warring traditions still. And so I hope that my perspective can maybe shed a little light on how to understand that. What I was trying to explain, to think about what explains, so if you grant me the premise that the two stories have coexisted, the story of freedom and the story of segregation, then I try to think about, okay, well, what explains the coexistence of those things in Northern history? And part of my answer was that it's the presence and the power of what I call the Northern mystique. And what I mean by the Northern mystique is I argue that a mystique about the noble Northern past has exerted a powerful influence through much of the region's history, certainly the 20th century, the period that I study. And what I mean by that is a set of ideas and ideals that yes, the North is more free and the North is perhaps better. That set of ideas and ideals, but that has interacted with the harder stuff of public policy and urban and suburban landscapes. Anyway, so what I think is that in some moments, the mystique, the belief that the North was freer, helped to propel Northerners forward, African Americans in the North as well as whites in the North, as they took steps toward racial equality. They had the belief, Massachusetts, for instance, was a place that could elect a black senator, Ed Brook. The voters really believed that, and that's what helped to create the fact. But at the same time, white Northerners deployed those ideas about the North. They deployed the mystique as a way of obscuring the segregation and racism that existed. So they said, hey, we elected Ed Brook, a black senator. That means we have freedom and equality. So I think it worked both ways. It allowed for breakthroughs like that on the one hand, and it also allowed for the obscuring and, I would say, the hiding of racism and segregation. So I think that this dual functioning of the concept of the Northern Mystique can help explain sort of the dual history of the North. Among white Northerners, I found that there was a surprising amount of agreement when it came to race. That is, progressives and racial conservatives both believed that their region was a bastion of racial tolerance. Here's one of the most famous segregationists in the history of Boston, Louise Day Hicks, who was the head of the Boston School Committee during the 1960s. And Louise Day Hicks said, "The important thing is that I know I'm not bigoted. To me, that word means all the dreadful Southern segregationist Jim Crow business that's always shocked and revolted me." So even the Northern racists claimed that they were enlightened when relative to the Southern racists. And yet, at the same time, even Northern liberals were committed to segregation. That is, white liberals in Massachusetts often opposed open housing and often opposed many plans for school integration. So I found that there was actually a lot of crossover between both white liberals and white conservatives believed that, say, in the realm of politics, African Americans should be able to rise high. But when it came to the stuff of everyday life in terms of integrating housing, integrating towns, integrating schools, I don't think that progressives or white conservatives really gave many of those proposals the push that they needed. And so it's a sort of a contradictory white mindset that I think has led to this. And what I emphasize is this idea of colorblindness, where whites like Louise Day Hicks, as well as white liberals, all claimed that they were colorblind. They claimed that when they went into the voting booth, they didn't take a candidate's race into account. They also claimed that when they were assigning kids to schools, they didn't take their race into account. So that could allow for sort of interracial breakthroughs at the ballot and also allow for the continuing of school segregation. And this is what I found, really, throughout my story. Moments of progress in the realm of electoral politics often and certain cultural arenas, and yet dogged and persistent segregation on the level of spatial segregation, residential segregation, school segregation. And when I set out to figure out what actual stories I would tell in the book, I looked for those places, those cities, those moments where I could tell the two stories together. The story of a march toward freedom unfolding at the same time and in the same place as the story of segregation cementing itself. And what I focused on during World War II was, well, my hometown, Springfield, which pioneered something called the Springfield Plan. And so during World War II, okay, here's a moment where the white leaders of the Northeast fancied themselves as, in a way, the last best hope for freedom, because they saw Hitler marching across Europe, across the Atlantic, and they also saw totalitarianism in its own form below the Mason-Dixon line. And they thought the North was sort of poised between these two places, the American South and the fascist, Europe that was becoming fascist. And so what the leaders of Springfield did was they instituted a plan that they said would abolish prejudice from their city. It was called the Springfield Plan. And they said it would abolish racial and religious prejudice from Springfield. And they wanted to do that by instituting a curriculum in the schools that they said would teach tolerance and would wipe out racism and prejudice. It didn't work. Racism and prejudice certainly continued to exist and persist. The way that they did it tells us something about wartime America, World War II America, which is that they focused on white minds. And they thought if you got prejudice out of white minds, you could then build a society that was racially just. And what they didn't look at was the structures of segregation in their very own city. And what I mean by that is during World War II, well, this is when the Second Great Migration really began, and African Americans were flocking from the South to northern cities like Springfield. And those migrants were basically forced and corralled into certain very specific neighborhoods and certain very specific schools. And so while segregation was building in the schools and the neighborhoods, the leaders of the Springfield Plan said that they were wiping out racism from their city. There was a similar dynamic at work after World War II in Jackie Robinson's Brooklyn. And that's an image of the sort of interracial crowd at a Dodgers game during Jackie Robinson's years in Brooklyn. And after World War II, this is where I shifted my focus to Jackie Robinson's Brooklyn. I was always mindful when I was doing the Jackie Robinson research that in 1947, this was a nation that had not yet heard of Rosa Parks or Martin Luther King. And so Jackie Robinson's breakthrough, you know, he was a true pioneer. And I think the fact that, he broke down the barriers in the game of baseball and was for the most part welcomed by Brooklyn fans, though there were some important exceptions of fans who did not welcome him even in Brooklyn. That I didn't want to understate that or underestimate the meaning of that for African Americans as well as white Americans, that Robinson could do that. But what's amazing about the Brooklyn story is that if you look just down the street from Ebbets Field, you can see ghettos forming in the exact same years that Jackie Robinson was playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers. That's 1947 to 57. That was his decade in Brooklyn. Those are the exact same years that the neighborhood known as Bedford-Stuyvesant was going from an integrated neighborhood to an almost all-black neighborhood during those years. And so what I did was try to focus on those two stories basically at the same time as a way of showing how Robinson could make his breakthrough in this famous cultural arena, and yet how spatial and residential segregation could congeal and cement at the same time. And Jackie and Rachel Robinson themselves experienced housing discrimination firsthand. They bought a home in the late 1940s in the neighborhood of St. Albans, which was in Queens, where many upwardly mobile African Americans had bought homes. Roy Campanella had bought a home nearby. I believe Duke Ellington also had one in St. Albans. And so the Robinsons owned a home in St. Albans. And then in the early 1950s, well, they were smitten with the American dream of the early 1950s, just like everyone else in America, which is what they wanted, a home in the suburbs. They wanted a house with a yard and a lawn. And so they started looking for houses in Westchester County, New York, and in Fairfield County, Connecticut. And Rachel Robinson recounts the crass indignities that they confronted day after day after day in that home search. She recounts how, with great zest, She had she opened the New York Times every Sunday, opened the real estate section, and tried to look for those listings. And each time she called and gave her name, she was told that the house was just removed from the market, or that, you know, no, it wasn't available for one reason or another. And so the Robinsons, who at this point were certainly one of the most famous African-American couples in America at the time, even they couldn't go and see homes that were listed, you know, which reinforced to me the extent of housing discrimination and housing segregation. This particular story ended fairly happily with the town of North Stamford and Connecticut. So this was the whites in North Stamford got together. Well, actually, they were really shamed into doing something more than really wanting to do something. There was a newspaper article printed in the Bridgeport Herald where the headline said, North Stamford nixes Jackie Robinson. And the white liberals in North Stamford were enraged and humiliated, and they didn't want that to be their reputation. So they got together at the country home of Richard Simon, who was the publisher of Simon & Schuster. They got together, they invited the Robinsons over, they had some ministers over, some leaders of the town, and they ensured the Robinsons that goodwill would prevail in North Stamford. They would get to see the homes that they wanted to see. And so the realtors showed the Robinsons some homes around, and finally they took to this one house with a sort of a house being built at the moment on a pond. And that was the moment when Rachel Robinson said she really felt like an American for the first time, when she could actually purchase a home that she wanted to purchase. And so the Robinsons did get that home, although, and there's a picture of them playing Scrabble in it in the 1950s. But the point there is that the Robinsons, again, were exceptional. And if they had to expend that much toil and sweat and heartache in order to find a home over several years, there were many thousands of anonymous African Americans who were not able to successfully, complete that quest for a home. So the point is, by this time, the 1950s, these patterns of residential and school segregation had really been cemented in the cities and suburbs of the North and the Northeast. And so I then turned my eye to movements, African-American movements, against school segregation and against housing segregation. And honestly, I didn't mean to write another chapter about Springfield. I'm not just trying to write a book about Springfield. But I wrote another chapter about Springfield because one of the most important early school segregation lawsuits concerned the schools of Springfield, Massachusetts. And there were a group of black parents who filed a lawsuit in 1964, claimed that the city of Springfield was segregating its schools intentionally, and the NAACP represented the black parents of Springfield, and Robert Carter argued their case in the district court. Robert Carter was, sort of Thurgood Marshall's second in command during the Brown versus Board case. So anyway, Robert Carter argued the case in the courtroom, and it was actually a fascinating legal argument, where what Robert Carter did was he argued against the ideology of colorblindness. This was fascinating because during Brown versus Board, the NAACP had argued that the Constitution was colorblind and that it could make no distinctions among races and classes. What Robert Carter said is that when you have a city that's segregated and a school system that's segregated, you can't be colorblind. Because if you are colorblind, then you're blind to the existing segregation. So what he did 10 years after Brown, he sort of made an argument against colorblindness and showed why the officials in Springfield would have to take race into account if they wanted to have a free and a fair city. The whites in Springfield protested. They said, "We're not segregationists." You know, they said, "If we were segregationists, we would have written in our law books that whites would have to send their kids to this school and blacks to that school." Anyway, the NAACP won the lawsuit at the district court level, and it was actually, for a moment, it was a great triumph there. Unfortunately, the appellate court overturned the decision. But I found it to be a fascinating insight into the way that African Americans were fighting against school segregation in the North, both at the sort of grassroots level of parents and children in Springfield and also at the higher sort of legal court level in terms of the NAACP. So that was 1964, 1965. And then Ed Brooks' campaign for the U.S. Senate came in 1966. And Brooke is a sort of, the book returns to him more often than it returns to any other individual. Because Ed Brooke was from Washington, D.C., which was a segregated place in the early 20th century. And he's a person who came to Massachusetts and sort of rose extremely high in Massachusetts public life and in politics. I got that photo from the Gottlieb Research Center across the street. So I figured I would show it. This is two white suburbanites supporting Brooke in his bid for attorney general. That would either be 62 or 64. Well, he's already attorney general, so that's 64. Ed Brooke had a triple whammy going against him. He was an African American in a state that was 97% white, and he was an Episcopalian in a state that was heavily Catholic, and he was also a Republican in a state that had a vast majority of Democrats. And so on paper, you know, I hear about the story of Ed Brooke. I mean, how did he win two elections as attorney general and then win two elections in the United States Senate? He's still the only African American to serve two full terms in the United States Senate. Thinking to myself, you know, first of all, I hadn't really heard of Ed Brooke growing up in Springfield, and then I study civil rights and political history. How can that be? He's been forgotten by a lot of our histories. I think a lot of people nowadays think of a black Republican and think that he's basically conservative. And he was very moderate in his temperament at the time. He wasn't a very vocal liberal. At least at first, he was not a vocal fighter for the civil rights movement. He thought of himself as a politician and not an activist, and he thought there was a distinction there. But if you look at his policy record, he voted very liberally. I mean, he voted for all the civil rights and open housing measures time and time again. What he did during his campaign in order to convince millions of whites in Massachusetts to vote for him was he did two things that were sort of contradictory. On the one hand, he said, "Vote for my record and don't think about my race when you go into the voting booth." You know, he said, "I've been attorney general 4 years. You know my record. You know who I am. You know, that's who you should, that's the basis on which you should vote." And his opponent was Chubb Peabody in the 1966 U.S. Senate race. So he said that, you know, this is sort of, he claimed it's a sort of colorblind campaign. But on the other hand, he was always winking and nudging Massachusetts voters and saying stuff about what a great history Massachusetts had in terms of its heritage of freedom and liberty. And he was telling voters that, you know, if any state can forge a breakthrough, it's Massachusetts that can do it. It's the great Bay State. You know, you're capable of it. And I think he played on this notion of what I was calling the Northern Mystique. And he played on what whites in Massachusetts wanted to think about themselves in terms of Massachusetts being a beacon for the rest of the country. So I think he, and what he did was he pulled it off. He pulled off the balancing act of, on the one hand, saying, just vote my record and not my race, and on the other hand, sort of winking and nodding and nudging and saying, we in the Bay State can do it. There was a really incendiary cartoon that was published the Sunday before the election in the Boston Herald. And the Boston Herald would not allow me to print this in the book. So again, you get to coming to the... There's just the second thing you learned from the talk that you wouldn't learn in the book. But, you know, it's a very incendiary cartoon. So what you have in the fall of 1966 is the white backlash was gaining headlines everywhere in the country. You know, white voters pissed off about civil rights. And there were riots in certain cities. And in the midst of it all, Ed Brooke was running this campaign for the Senate. And the, you know, the story started to be in the newspapers, would Massachusetts succumb to the backlash? Would Ed Brooke be felled by the backlash? And here's this cartoon just trading in, you know, crass sort of racial caricature, caricaturing Brooke clearly as a sort of modern-day slave with the word backlash literally lashed into his back. In the end, Massachusetts elected him. They did not cave to the backlash, and the voters were able to spin this narrative of them themselves and Brooke overcoming the darker forces of racism and whatnot. I moved on later in the decade to Shirley Chisholm. And initially, I was looking at Shirley Chisholm as a sort of a foil against Ed Brooke, because what I had known about Shirley Chisholm was that she championed her identity both as a woman and as an African American, and that is true. I mean, she did indeed embrace that identity, embrace her blackness in a way that Brooke at certain times tried to downplay it in order to win office. But I also found that Shirley Chisholm was extremely savvy at building a multiracial coalition in her own way. There were some important differences here. Ed Brooke was running statewide in a state that was 97% white, whereas Shirley Chisholm was running for Congress in one congressional district of Brooklyn that was about half African American, and that was minority white because you also had about a quarter of that population was Latino. But Shirley Chisholm, when she ran in the Democratic primary, she ran against another black candidate. And so those two candidates essentially split the African-American vote in Bedford-Stuyvesant. And what Shirley Chisholm had to do was she had to develop a campaign message that would resonate with those voters in Bed-Stuy, on the one hand, but also where she could reach out to the white neighborhoods that were in her district. And at that time, Bushwick was almost entirely white. Crown Heights had a lot of whites, particularly Jews. Williamsburg had a large number of Orthodox Jews in it. And so she was, in a fascinating way, she was building a campaign message that spoke not only to the African Americans in Bed-Stuy, but also to the whites in these other neighborhoods. So in a way, I found Chisholm and Brooke to be kindred spirits in the politics of multiracial coalition building, more than being actual foils. And I portray the 60s as a time when multiracial and interracial coalitions were still possible in the North and the Northeast. And I think, so in a way, the 1960s are a sort of high time with Brooke and Chisholm of sort of multiracialism. And the 70s would be something different. And I'm going to skip ahead so that I can finish this up and have plenty of time to talk about it, see what other images I have. There's Chisholm. I have a great story in the book about Abraham Ribicoff, which I'm not going to get into. Well, briefly, Abraham Ribicoff declared on the U.S. Senate floor that the North was guilty, guilty of monumental hypocrisy, of racism and segregation, and white Southerners hailed him as a hero. And in this cartoon from Richmond, Virginia, they built a monument to Abe Ribicoff next to the monument to Robert E. Lee, because he was finally the Northern liberal who would say the truth that the North was bad too. And I do have a chapter about Ribicoff's speech where he lambasts the North on the Senate floor, and white Southerners all hailed him as a hero. And then a year later, Ribicoff developed an actual plan to integrate all the schools in the country. And he developed this huge grand proposal in which urban and suburban school systems would have to come up with plans to integrate their schools, and he was going to give them 13 years from 1970 to 1983. It was going to be this long and grand plan. And the NAACP opposed it. And the NAACP said 13 years is too long to wait for our schools to be integrated. They said, we've been waiting since the Brown v. Board decision, 1954. And it is one of those moments that sort of boggles the mind to see, wow, NAACP opposed it because 1983 would be too long to wait for our schools to be integrated. Of course, white Southerners also proposed the plan because they thought Ribicoff was just sort of talking about racism and segregation at first. When he offered an actual plan in which all the cities would have to integrate their schools, white Southerners said, well, maybe we're going to take down these statues of Ribicoff next to Robert E. Lee. Finally, I want to talk a little bit about Ed Brooks' policies, because I think just talking about him as a campaigner doesn't quite do him justice. When I looked into Ed Brooks' policies, I found that he was almost alone. He was an advocate and a supporter of busing in order to achieve integration. And of course, you know, the busing crisis in Boston was hugely controversial, you know, made the city into a cauldron of racial violence and racism. And Ed Brook occupied this amazingly unique place in the American political spectrum. He was the only African American in the United States Senate, and yet he represented Massachusetts, which was the center of the anti-busing movement at the time in the 1970s. And here you have an anti-busing crowd, you know, wanting to bus Brooke to retirement, among others. And the anti-bussers made it clear that they were opposed to Ed Brooke and opposed to his stance. But what Ed Brooke did was he, time and again, he stood on the floor of the United States Senate and he said, you know, he said, I don't love the busing proposals. I don't think this is the best way to bring integration to our cities. But he said, you know, he pointed out the reality of the situation. Brown v. Board had been passed in 1954. The Massachusetts State Legislature had passed the Racial Imbalance Act in 1965, which said that cities in Massachusetts had to integrate their schools. And here we are, 1974. Boston School Committee hasn't lifted a finger. It's still segregated. And furthermore, the leaders of Boston, to every possible integration proposal, have voted it down, have hollered it down, have yelled it down, have convinced the whites in Boston that integration is never going to come to the schools. And so what Ed Brooks said was, you know, we have to at least allow busing as a tool to bring integration. As he saw it, the choice was between busing and segregation at that moment. And so he stood on the Senate floor time and again, and he said, you know, we've got to at least allow busing to be an instrument in lawmakers' arsenal. And the person who opposed him on the Senate floor, more often than not, was Joe Biden, the freshman senator from Delaware. Joe Biden had won his first election to the Senate by claiming that he was in support of school integration. But then Wilmington, Delaware started to get the possibility of busing orders looming over it. And Biden's constituents started to stage rallies and, you know, meetings in school gymnasiums where Biden would come in and say, why don't we be for integration? And they shout him out, jeer him out of the whole place. And very quickly, Joe Biden made a switch. And he became one of the leaders of the anti-busing movement in the Senate. What was fascinating to see was these moments in which you really had Brooke against Biden. The lone African-American senator versus the man who we know now, having the benefit of hindsight, would become Obama's vice president. And so to read the arguments and the battles between Brooke and Biden was something to behold. I did make it up in my book. I had some chapters on the black mayors of the 1980s and the racism in New York City and the racial violence. I have a chapter on Dinkins in New York, and I also have a chapter on a guy named Thurman Milner in Hartford. And then I bring the story sort of up to the present with Deval Patrick and finally Barack Obama. There's Obama bestowing the Congressional Medal upon Ed Brooke. And it's admittedly, in the end, a somewhat optimistic story in my book, which I finished early in 2014, where I was writing in the aftermath of Obama's re-election, which I thought to be very significant, the fact that American voters had not only elected a black president, but had looked at his record and chosen to re-elect him. And I was writing about Deval Patrick's re-election as well, and I was feeling somewhat optimistic, though not blind to the realities. And of course, if I had extended the book another year, I would have to say that I would have had to end it on a more pessimistic note. Of course, with what we've seen in the country the past year and year and a half in terms of race relations and brutality, white brutality. You know, I still think that the nation has these two sides to it, and I still think it's a question as to which one we would embrace, but I am much less optimistic now than when I finished the book almost 2 years ago. Thank you.
I enjoyed your talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Particularly intrigued by Biden. I didn't know that. You may have caused me to do a little rethinking here. But anyway, when you spoke of the three strikes against Ed Brooke,
yep.
I wondered if you were going to mention his marriage.
And oh, yeah.
That wasn't a strike then?
Well, the fact that he was married to a white woman?
Yeah.
Of course. And so he was married to a woman who he had met in Italy. She was Italian. And, you know, in his first campaign for the Attorney General, 1962, against Francis Kelly, and Francis Kelly was what you'd think he is from his name. You know, he was an Irish Democratic machine politician. And Kelly tried to make an issue of that. He said something about, you know, Brooke has a white wife. He said that on the radio. Brooke's response there was to try to turn the racial issue and you know, say Massachusetts voters are above that sort of thing. I would certainly take your point that there is a sort of fourth one going against him.
Well, maybe it wasn't. But
yeah.
While I have the mic, I'll just ask my second question.
Okay.
And you speak of the balance between segregation and freedom uh-huh. in the North and those hopefulness there. Was there a similar kind of balance in the South that people would speak to?
Right.
Certainly, we would expect segregation, but was there another side in the South as well?
What I would say is that, at least as I think of it, there were certain moments where in the North it was almost a fair fight between the forces of democracy and the forces of segregation. I think in the South, those moments were far more rare. And I think the South's history was much more one-sided in terms of the forces of segregation and racism always winning out. Now, I would have to say that, you know, the greatest social movement for freedom and democracy emerged out of the South, out of the Black South. And so I do want to make sure I acknowledge that. And so the South does, you know, did have that opening where the civil rights movement could emerge. But if that, yeah. And I have an article in Politico that's on the whole Biden thing, if you're interested. Oh, yeah. it has all of the quotes from Biden calling busing an asinine policy and so forth. So you can take a look.
I was reading many years ago Caro's book on...
LBJ or Robert Moses?
No, Moses.
Yeah.
Caro paints a very negative picture of him with regard to blacks, and I wonder if you comment on that in your book, or if you could comment on that now. He said that he was a blatant anti-African-American, and he did many things in his building that prevented African-Americans from selling in Long Island, for instance, or right. using Jones Beach, or those kinds of things.
Basically, I accept Caro's argument. I accept that Caro's the expert on Robert Moses. You know, I think Moses's use of public space certainly helped to create segregated spaces. I think he definitely did that, and you know, the master of many urban renewal plans that went right through black neighborhoods. So I would accept Caro's argument, unless certainly would be open to other evidence. But
I just wondered if you mentioned it in your book, since that was the period in New York City that you right. were covering.
Right. I think the only time that I actually mentioned Moses, one thing he did was he built the highways to the World's Fair, 1939, in Queens, and that's where my book starts. Sort of the World's Fair happening in New York and World War II overseas. So Moses helped to make that kind of thing possible. Moses also was instrumental in the Dodgers leaving for Los Angeles, where the owner of the Dodgers originally wanted to stay in Brooklyn, but he wanted to build a big new stadium with a parking lot, and that's right where the Brooklyn Nets arena is now in downtown Brooklyn, the Atlantic Yards area. And Robert Moses made sure that they could not get the permits for that spot. Instead, he offered to, you know, sell them a place up in Queens at great profit to his own authority. So I think part of why the Dodgers left was because Moses denied them that spot. Yeah.
Thanks. I wonder if you have any comments about the state of racial integration in the public schools at this point. Mm. Certainly in the public eye, we think of that as a major issue of the 60s and 70s, but something that we've put aside and grown past.
Right.
But could you give us some idea of what is the state of integration of the public schools at this point?
As far as I know, public schools are quite segregated racially. I think that's a trend that has basically increased with each passing year, unless you know stats to the contrary.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to suggest the opposite.
Yeah.
I asked the question because I've heard what you're suggesting, that, it's as much of a problem now as ever.
Yeah, it is. And if you look at the actual stats, I mean, these cities of the Northeast that I'm talking about as places of possible freedom have some of the most entrenched segregation statistics. Even New York City has one of the most. New York City, Chicago, Boston, right? Boston. You know, these places, the racial segregation of the schools, the public schools, just astounding percentages. Yeah.
Because I was going to bring up the issue of charter schools as a form of continuing the segregation and elitism
right.
in the schools. So I was going to ask for your comment on that.
Right, on charter schools?
Yes.
You know, I don't know enough about the whole charter school debate, but I'm willing to accept your argument that it's another form of elitism and going to further the trends of segregation. Yeah.
And did you interview people who were related to Brooke?
Yeah, I was actually fortunate enough to interview Brooke himself. He was extremely gracious. You know, obviously, you know, he had been having health problems, cancer, but he was doing great when I talked with him. I asked him about busing, and he claimed that he was no great defender of school busing. But that's one of those instances where I went back to the archival record, and I really believe he was a great defender of school busing. But I think he realized that that's one issue that most Americans agree now was catastrophic, school busing. You'll find very few defenders of forced busing, as it's known, right? And Brooke was also, you know, when I interviewed him, I guess once a politician, always a politician. He was very savvy in his, I found him to be very forthcoming and generous and honest. But I could also tell that he was a politician and sort of, you know, recounting things in a certain light. But I'm
sure Biden will be doing the same.
Right.
Okay, so thanks for everybody. And we look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Jason Sokol, Associate Professor of History from the University of New Hampshire. Professor Sokol's lecture was titled All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn, and was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Tonight's moderator was African American Studies Program Director John Thornton. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived versions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Kalo. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.